Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Well, folks, welcome back, and it is now or never, and we've got Paul Venable with us to do some more cogent reading, and I really appreciate your time with us. And Paul, you got to admit that 55 minutes just flies by.
It just, right. When we ended, I thought we were under. We were having a break.
We're still on the first half, right. I know. Okay, so we ended yesterday in talking about these general welfare and defense, and technically what ended up happening was Randolph did not, he did not settle this question, and it came up again and again, and the Anti-Federalists said, look, you have not really clarified. And so Nicholas ends up, you know, talking about it, Madison talks about it, and Randolph talks about it. I'm sure some other people talk about it, but during the debates, because almost everybody, you know, kind of got up, the real fear, because it was all about fear-mongering and demagoguery, these powers were dreaded. These were the evilest powers of all governments ever formed. At least that's how the Anti-Federalists had to really depict this. And so, you know, they had to clamor about direct taxes, you know, and because they didn't want that. And they realized, and it was even brought up by Nicholas earlier, that no government in the world was really funding itself by direct taxes. They were surviving off of imposts.
Sure.
So anyway, and you got to understand that when Britain, you know, as it became an empire, Britain actually started invoking lots of little taxes here and there. I mean, they had a lot of excise taxes, the stamp taxes and so forth. And Britain was actually starting to lay duties or direct taxes, you know, that 1/10 of a cent that they started levying. And that 1/10 of a cent was, you know, this whole cry, no taxation without representation.
Wow.
And that's, you know, and had they actually, had Britain, just think about this, had Britain allowed the colonies to have representation in Parliament, it would have been done.
Sure. Well, what was their hang-up with that, by the way? What was their hang-up with the colonies having representation in Parliament? Because that's really what they wanted.
Because those people over there weren't as good as the people that stayed in Britain. It was a superiority complex.
Wow.
And, you know, when you really boil it down, everybody should just be, and I actually believe that this pride, this persona that Britain had, and they, you know, isolated themselves in this little bubble, I see that as the divine hand of providence intervening, because Britain, as it was being created as this new empire, you know, you got to realize that it, out of a nation that had the most limited resources, they were surrounded by water. It was a small nation, and they became the empire of the world.
Oh, no, they're not much bigger than the state of Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, for this little teeny state to still control and manipulate the world today.
Right.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and for as long as they had been doing it for the last, I mean, they haven't been doing it like the Roman Empire or, you know, the Egyptian Empire, but, you know, the magnitude of the growth and how they've really diversified their nefarious ways and their manipulation, you know, kudos. So anyway, we're going to start off with a comment from James Monroe. And at this point in time, he is really trying to make this comment as an anti-federalist. And so I realize that, you know, that first shot up by Governor Randolph that we just read on the general welfare clause, and they also talked about the sweeping clause, he didn't really hit the ball out of the park. As a matter of fact, I think he struck out because he really didn't end the argument. And I believe that regardless of how well it got addressed down the road, the anti-federalists were still trying. I mean, they were going to their deathbeds in denying that how it was explained was actually, you know, pretty clear and you know, assuring that this federal government wasn't getting those types of powers. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah, so now this is the same James Monroe who later became the fifth president of the United States, right?
Yes, who was at the seat when the Missouri Compromise was passed by Congress, yes. The same.
Okay. Okay, so here we go. James Monroe, anti-federalist note. What is the object of the division of power in America? Why is the government divided into different branches? For more faithful and regular administration, where is there a check? We have more to apprehend from the nation, the union of these branches than from the subversion of any. And this union will destroy the rights of the people. There is nothing to prevent this coalition, but the contest which will probably subsist between the general government and the individual governments will tend to produce it. There is a division of sovereignty between the national and state governments. How far, then, will they coalesce together? Is it not to be supposed that there will be a conflict between them? If so, will not the members of the former combine together? Where, then, will be the check to prevent encroachments on the rights of the people? There's not a third essentially distinct branch to preserve a just equilibrium or to prevent such encroachments. In developing this plan of government, we ought to attend to the necessity of having checks. I can see no real checks in it. Let's first inquire into the probability of harmony between the general and individual governments, and in the next place, into the responsibility of the general government, either to the people at large or to the state legislatures. As to the harmony between the governments, communion of powers, legislative and judicial, forbids it.
Okay, so let me ask you something. Mm-hmm. Reading this, and he talking about this real complaint of no checks, did he not actually talk about the superior or the what I consider the most important checks of all, the checks and balances, you know, between the governments?
Mm-hmm.
And he did, but he wasn't seeing it. He's talking about the states actually having a check on the federal government. How is that not a check and balance?
This may sound like a dumb question, but how is it not a check and balance?
That's my point. So he's up there. So in other words, he's making an argument, and he's actually, it's almost like, you know, a defense attorney getting up and talking about, you know, how their client is, you know, innocent of murder, but they lay out the argument of how he's guilty. Yeah, he was there. Yeah, you know, they have the evidence of this, but he didn't do it. I mean, he's basically making a claim, but he's actually supporting the fact that there's one of the best and most important fundamental checks and balances is the states that they have over the union itself, over the general government.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. So I didn't see that.
That's okay. All right. So
okay.
So moving down, we now have John Marshall, who has not become the Supreme Court Chief Justice yet.
Right.
All right.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I conceive that the object of the discussion now before us is whether democracy or despotism be most eligible. He used the term democracy here. I'll go on, but I just wanted to point that out.
Right.
I am sure that those who framed the system submitted to our investigations and those who now support it intend the establishment and security of the former. The supporters of the Constitution claim the fighty of being firm friends of liberty and the rights of mankind. They say that they consider it as the best means of protecting liberty. We, sir, idolize democracy. There he goes again. Those who supposed to have bestowed eulogiums on monarchy. We prefer this system to any monarchy because we are convinced that it has a greater tendency to secure our liberty and promote our happiness. We admire it because we think it a well-regulated democracy. It is recommended that the good people of this country, they are through us, to declare whether it be such a plan of government as will establish and secure their freedom. I hope you don't mind if...
No. I'm expecting you to say, hey, he used the word little d democracy three times.
Right. Okay. So he expected me to... So, yeah, I'm looking for something here.
He's not using the capital D democracy.
Okay.
In other words, you have to admit that the people in a democratic process select their representatives.
Okay, sure. That's
okay.
Correct.
So that's half of the government. In all stages, that is half of the government. Remember, this is why I talked about and even extend to large counties needing to actually have bicameral legislative bodies to have that check and balance to guard from a large democracy of people in a small area.
Sure. Okay.
Now, so, that's a little d democracy.
It's not that it's a swear word, because there is a place for it. And that's where you choose your representative.
Correct. And that's the only place where the democratic process is to be used, is in we the people, choosing our three representatives, our county representative, our state representative, and our federal representative. I lose you on that?
No, you didn't lose me. Go ahead.
Okay. So, in other words, we engage in an election where through a democratic process, you know, the majority carries to whomever got the majority of votes as the representative of those people, county, state, federal. So in essence, when he's talking about the democracy, it is the democracy of the people get to choose. See, there is an aristocracy where a family, you know, is actually, you know, bestowed upon the privilege of taking care of those people, like the land barons in Britain. Or there is a, you know, could be a monarchical where, you know, there are the other families that, you know, are elite, they're considered ordained and anointed by God to be the, you know, the people's leaders. But in this Republican form of government, we have a democratic process, sorry about that, folks, a process of choosing who is going to represent us. But that is it. We do not, by a democratic process, choose our president.
Right.
We are to choose the candidate's elector.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. Got it. Next paragraph. Permit me to attend to what the honorable gentleman, Mr. Henry, has said. He has expatiated on the necessity of a due attention to certain maxims, to certain fundamental principles, from which a free people ought never to depart. I concur with him in the propriety of the observance of such maxims. They are necessary in any government, but more essential to a democracy, than to any other. What are the favorite maxims of democracy? A strict observance of justice and public faith and a steady adherence to virtue. These, sir, are the principles of a good government. No mischief, no misfortune ought to deter us from a strict observance of justice and public faith. Would to heaven that these principles had been observed under the present government. Had this been the case, the Friends of Liberty would not be so willing now to part with it. Was John Marshall a fan of the Articles of Confederation? This sentence makes me question, you know, you know, had this been the case, the Friends of Liberty would not be so willing to part with it. And I think he's referring to the articles.
Uh-huh. So, okay. No, he wasn't. Okay. He actually wanted, because he was Hamilton's protege, and he actually preferred a more centralized power in government. So that's why over the course of his career, he made rulings aggrandizing the federal government's powers more than they actually had.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Which is considered as some kind of precedent now. He's looked at it.
Well, he's the one that actually laid the stage for precedents.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Can we boast that our government is founded on these maxims? Can we pretend to the enjoyment of political freedom or security when we are told that a man has been, by an act of assembly, struck out of existence without a trial by jury, without examination, without being confronted with his accusers and witnesses, without the benefits of the law of the land? Where is our safety when we are told that this act was justifiable because the person that was not a Socrates? What has become of the worthy member's maxims? Is this one of them? Shall it be a maxim that a man shall be deprived of his life without the benefit of law? Shall such a deprivation of life be justified by answering that the man's life was not taken secundum artem because he was a bad man? Shall it be a maxim that government ought not be to be empowered to protect virtue? Okay. This bears some discussion. He's using some terms here. Secundum artem.
But he was a lawyer, so, you know, they use Latin.
Right.
Right.
All right. And so I'm just trying to wrap my head around what this last few words.
So the green highlight, he's actually pointing out that this general government ought not to be empowered to protect virtue.
Okay.
Okay. So, because if it actually protects virtue, then it can define virtue.
Okay.
This is what we've seen. This is why you know, we didn't want to give government the ability to, you know, to mandate a Christian faith or a very specific denomination, that they wanted to make sure it was really, you know, these are the only things you can do. We don't want it to actually be able to, because if it can be empowered to protect virtue, it can actually pervert virtue.
Correct. Okay. Makes sense.
Okay. So the next one is a note from him on the interpositions.
Now, so we're back to interposition, right?
Right. And let's see how he uses interposition here. Yep.
The honorable gentleman has asked if there be any safety or freedom when we give away the sword and the purse. Shall the people at large hold the sword and the purse without the interposition of their representatives? Can the whole aggregate community act personally? I apprehend that every gentleman will see the impossibility of this. Must they then not trust them to others? To whom are they to trust them but to their representatives, who are accountable for their conduct? He represents secrecy as unnecessary and produces the British government as a proof of its inutility. Is there no secrecy there? When deliberating on the propriety of declaring war or on military arrangements, do they deliberate in the open fields? No, sir. The British government affords secrecy when necessary, and so ought every government. In this plan, secrecy is only used when it would be fatal and pernicious to publish the schemes of government.
Yeah. So the use of interposition here was actually in line with this concept of, you know, so what is interposing? It is reaching in and actually taking control. And he's talking here, shall the people at large hold the sword and purse without the interposition of the representatives? So, in other words, we have a representative form of government, not a democratic form of government.
Okay.
Can the whole aggregate community act personally? No.
Correct.
I apprehend that every gentleman will see, because, you know, this is one of the things I noted with Marshall. he would make a comment, and we'll get into one of them, which is ideal because I actually use it regarding the enumerated powers. He gets really specific in this one argument, but he asks questions. Do they have the mode of altering contracts? Do they have the mode of making laws that could actually affect those things? So he asks these questions, question, and then he goes on to explain something. So it's unfortunately, I think I have gotten into the way of thinking and saying things like they do, where, you know, you start off with the conclusion and then you kind of lay out, you know, the information that supports those conclusions. And we don't usually think that way. But 9 times out of 10, people, you know, lay out the information, the arguments, and then they create, then they submit the conclusion. And so it's backwards. And anyway, so when people read it, they get confused of why they're framing it the way they did. And it doesn't, you know, sometimes it just doesn't jump out as making sense. I get that. So anyway, so okay, so that's Marshall for now. Now we're going to go into an anti-federalist, George Mason, where he talks about common law.
Now,
this is just George a quick Mason line. This Nicholas. Is just a quick line, first off, yes.
I got George Nicholas, but okay.
Oh, hold it. No, you're right. It is George Nicholas. I was reading it from a distance. You're right.
So George Nicholas is an anti-federalist, right?
Anti-federalist, yes.
So here's a line here. Here's a sentence here that's highlighted. He will be absolutely disqualified to hold any office, any place of profit, honor, or trust, and liable to further punishment if he has committed such high crimes as are punishable at common law. Okay.
Okay, so who's he talking about? And so this is kind of an interesting little statement because, in other words, if you commit a crime, certain types of crimes that are punishable at common law, then he shall absolutely be disqualified to hold any. So let's go and look up at the top. And this is kind of important. Now I'm going to highlight the whole thing. So just go ahead and highlight it from the very top. Under the Confederate, Congress cannot make a treaty. Go ahead. Now you're going to read the whole thing again.
Under the Confederation, Congress cannot make a treaty without the consent of 9 states. Congress, by the proposed plan, cannot make a treaty without the consent of 2/3 of the senators present and of the president. 2/3 will amount to 9 states. If the senators from all the states be present, can it be candidly and fairly supposed that they will not all or nearly all be present when so important a subject as a treaty is to be agitated? The consent of the president is a very great security. He is elected by the people at large. He will not have the local interests which the Congress, members of Congress may have. If he deviates from his duty, he is responsible to his constituents. He will be degraded and will bring on his head the accusation of the representatives of the people, an accusation which has ever been and always will be very formidable. And then here's the line again. He will be absolutely disqualified to hold any place of profit, honor, or trust, and liable to further punishment if he committed such high crimes as are punishable at common law.
Okay. Which means so if the president committed adultery, he should have been actually punished and actually been disqualified. Does that qualify? I mean, when we start looking at presidential behavior, have we ever seen a president actually committing those types of crimes that are punishable by common law?
Sure we have. What did we do? They're punishable by common law. That's interesting.
Okay, so we're actually going into a break, so I'll let you think about that. We'll ponder on this, and then when we come back, I'll, you know, get your views and insights on this, but there are examples out there. So we'll be with those examples right after this promo. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so right here, he's actually talking about the president. Okay, so the line you read is he will absolutely be disqualified. Now, this who he is and or she today, right? Who knows? I'm laughing. Kamala Harris may become the first female president. But anyway, that she won't be the one. But anyway, he will be disqualified to hold any place or of profit or honor or trust and liable to further punishment if he has committed such high crimes as are punishable at common law. Now, do we ever have a president that has actually committed, any type of crimes that are punishable at common law?
Of course.
Okay, so give me an example.
You mean Clinton?
Okay.
I mean the first example came to mind without a lot of thought. There may have been some others. This one is the most, it stands out.
Okay, so FDR, if you're talking about adultery, FDR, mm-hmm. and okay. John F. Kennedy.
Okay.
I mean, he actually had affairs in the White House, right? And it was actually in front of America.
Okay.
And by the time when Clinton came into office, it was almost like, we had completely turned our back on this paradigm that, you're not above the law. You can't commit any crime that is, punishable at common law. I would say, see, we've played around with laws to an extent that shoplifting is a, you got felony and misdemeanor. So shoplifting, unless it's for a certain amount, and nowadays it seems like $1,000 of shoplifting isn't even a misdemeanor. It is go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. In California, it's like a minor infraction. It's not even a misdemeanor.
Yeah. It's not just California. There's many, many states that have progressive blue states and cities, maybe not the states themselves, but the cities are not enforcing it because they, it would consume, they're saying that it would consume their courts and their jail system. And I'm actually saying otherwise, that if we actually held and we went back to these crimes of, you stealing blatantly like that, then that should be either a capital offense or a severe punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Car theft is the same thing as horse thievery. When mm-hmm. somebody goes down that path, if we started hanging people for, stealing cars and stealing, things of real value, then I'll mm-hmm. bet you anything theft would go down quite a bit. And if we actually started, quickly, you only had so much time to prove your innocence. And I'm a fan of the proof of innocence you know, and the burden of guilt. And so, you know, because we've actually had, you know, a bad system that, you know, ramrodded a lot of people. But I am in favor today, now that we actually have with DNA evidence and so forth, it gets really hard to prove somebody, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt that whether they've committed this heinous crime or not. And so if you actually have somebody dead to rights, to raping a woman, to raping a child, then the only way, and this is going down a rat hole here, but I've said this before, that the only way that they could actually have a retrial is if they were willing to take a lie detector test that, you know, that basically proves to some level of their innocence. Mm-hmm. Now, the tests are obviously not admissible into a court of law, but they have to at least prove to the court that there is something there that actually proves their innocence. And so anybody right. that actually really believes in that, then they're willing to take that. And if it is subjective enough to say, you know what, there is a good, you know, there's a good reflection here that this person actually, you know, through a lie detector test, you know, this voice stress analyzing and all of that, that, you know, this person's telling the truth. So we need to reexamine how the burden of proof was actually proven.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that would really clear things up, because I don't know how many. I know that there are people that have been, you know, kind of ramrodded through, but there are plenty of people that were caught dead to rights, and they still mm-hmm. get off on technicalities when that never should have happened.
Right.
That never, the technicalities should never happen. It's one thing that if there's reasonable doubt, but not because of a technicality.
Mm-hmm.
And so if... You know, if we actually reexamined and actually started holding people accountable to the law, our behavior would change dramatically. We would become much more law-abiding. And as a matter of fact, if the militia, if we the people were the enforcers of the law, you know, we would act. And if we all understood, see, what we all do is we all want a safety net. You know what? I make mistakes and I have the temptation. I might steal something someday. So, you know, if I ever do it, I wouldn't want to be really punished. I wouldn't want to be hanged for stealing something that I may have needed to steal. You know, so we always have that little, I'll just say, corruption in the back of our heads, trying to say, yeah, if that was me, if I had to do that, then, boy, I wouldn't want that to happen. And we can't, mm-hmm. we cannot take that position. We cannot be in that space. As a society, we have to demand discipline. And so, you know, when somebody actually has problems, but we've become so godless that the churches have turned, they're shut their doors and turned their backs on the people. They say, go to the state and get your help.
Oh, I know.
And so, you know, we've got a lot of things to do, but the churches can't step up and step into this until we get the government's heel of tyranny off their throats.
Right.
And so, and we need the people to actually demand, because if we actually started going back to church and actually started, you know, providing our fast offerings and tithes and, you know, contributions where we were honestly contributing, the churches would be far more capable of doing their job.
Let me run something by you.
Okay,
go ahead. Speaking of the government's heel of tyranny, okay? For example, 501c3 steps. So churches, ministers, religiously, so to speak, avoid speaking on matters of politics, liberty, candidates, etc. However, isn't the 501c3 status a violation of the First Amendment? Doesn't say Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. So you understand what I'm saying, where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
So I would think that there is a constitutional case against 501c3 status, where you get a, how should I say, a tax benefit as a group, as a class. The churches get a tax benefit as a class, but shut up. Keep quiet about the things that are important in our day. Don't you think that that is, that churches have a case, that the people have a case against this thing called a 501c3 status, which violates their freedom of speech?
Well, so the problem with the 501c nonprofit entity is the fact that it is regulated and mandated by the federal government. And so that itself right there is the problem, because the federal government doesn't have the authority to do that. Now, here's the question. Does the state have the authority to actually regulate, you know, any type of entity within it? Yes, absolutely. If you create an organization, they can demand that you register yourself with the state. Are you a corporation, a company, a self-proprietor, a nonprofit? And so the state, I think, would have the ability to do that.
But the state, I don't think, can violate the rights of the people for their free speech, regardless of what their status
now,
is.
Now, so the rights of the people,
right?
Yes, they cannot violate the rights of the people, but an entity or an organization is not the people.
Okay.
In other words, it's one thing if you have an unorganized religious worship where you don't have anybody in charge, no money involved or anything like that, then, you know, that is a, you know, they don't create regulations for that. Like, you know, when you stand out and you hold a sign, next thing you know, a whole bunch of people come over and they're supporting your cause and all of this. You created a body of people, but you didn't form an organization.
Okay.
When you form an organization, the organization itself, the state does have a responsibility to be able to, you know, understand what it's doing. Now, should it go down the path of regulating churches? And I'm going to tell you that, you know, when you really go down this path, you'd probably say yes. And I've said this before, and if you've listened to my shows, you'll know, and you'll go, you know, I got to agree that churches that have a doctrine of compulsion, a doctrine of non-respect of other rights, churches that basically are a theocracy and a controlling theocracy, such as communism, such as Islam, such as Luciferianism, you know, then those churches should not be allowed to be established because they do not respect the liberty of others.
Mm.
And they want to impose their immorality, because what does a Satanist want to do? They want to actually take immorality and impose immorality into the public, you know, allowing nudity, allowing, you know, obscenities and these types of things. See, there are plenty of, and they don't have to be Christian. They could be Jewish. They could be, you know, other faiths, Hindu or so forth, where they say, you know, we do believe that we should have a discipline as a society to not exposing our children to such material.
Okay.
And so do we not have a right to have some form of control and regulation? Because this is how Satanism, a form of religion, has actually been able to permeate into our education system to say, we have a right to teach your kids these things.
Mm. Mm.
So should states actually be able to say these types of doctrines are unacceptable? And that if you actually, it's one thing for you as a person to religiously, you know, worship. You have your right of worship and expression, but you do not have the right to violate the laws. In other words, exposing yourself or you know, taking, you know, erotic ideas or material, you know, as a form of expression in public. And so this way we actually can create, because we actually had good discipline. We understood that these things are harmful. They only debase our society. And look at where we are today, where, you know, our productivity is down in the gutter.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we're producing, I mean, there are more alcoholic distilleries for beer, wine, and everything else. I mean, the sin community, the sin world has literally, you know, become the primary money machine, primary market where most people spend their money, gambling, right. Pornography. So, I mean, look at Hollywood. Hollywood has basically been a huge advocate for trying to, you know, lower the bar and, you know, if they could have been doing, and they do soft porn. So anyway, so do you believe that the federal government should be involved in it? Probably not. Not at all. And as I said, the federal government has no, you know, delegated authority to be able to do that at all. But the states, they do have the responsibility. And yeah, I believe so. They should actually be able to have the standards. And as a matter of fact, if we do the constitutions right, you can actually make it so that the counties can actually be these petri dishes of testing, but not inflicting.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when one county says that they want to do it, that's just one voice of out of the 40 counties of the state. The common state has around 40 counties, I guess. I'm guessing. But, you know, you know, whatever that is. But that means that the population center, we don't use a democracy. So when we look at the amendment of a constitution in a state, they actually use a democracy by the vote of the people. Instead of using a ratification of a majority of the counties, a significant majority, not just a 50% plus one, a significant majority. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I know. How many states do you think do that? I know Missouri does.
Does what?
With change their constitutions.
Through democracy. All of them.
Wow.
There's not one state in the union that ever referred to a ratification of a majority of counties like the U.S. Constitution. Most people liked the ideas of democracy, and when they instituted their constitution, they did not protect the people from tyranny by the majority.
Right. Wow.
So okay. I'm just making another really good strong argument against allowing our constitutions to stand the way they are, that we actually have to have a constitutional convention, but we first have to take back our counties. And once we take back our counties to where we have a majority of the counties demanding the restoration of their representation in the Senate at the state legislature, then now you have the workings of a critical mass where the counties can intervene and basically descend upon a constitutional convention and say, look, you know, we appreciate the fact that you got a lot of people that live in that county, and that's up to you guys. But your county only has one, you're one party to the rest of us, and one county, one vote.
Right.
That's how it works, just like the United States constitutional model. And if the court system tries to say, no, a state can't do that, but the federal can, you're talking about people talking out both sides of their mouth.
Sure.
Right. As a matter of fact, the federal court system must actually support and enforce a supermajority, and one that's based on the sub-element of government itself. The fact is that the federal courts have deliberately attacked the counties over the past few decades, and that's what was essential in creating these massive majorities of these population centers. The person behind this was a very diabolical, evil person.
Who?
Satan.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Well, you know, the Constitution shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican form of government.
Right.
And we're failing there.
Yes. Yeah, so what we see now is we see, and We got about 8 minutes left of the show. What we're seeing now is we're seeing policies and decisions coming out of the court system that are really lending to a mob rule, tyranny by the majority. And even though we see the Supreme Court, you know, doing some things that people like, they've still yet to step in on the Electoral College and, you know, the tyranny by the majority on those types of issues. So,
yeah. So we have George Nicholas is about to talk about direct taxes. Do we have time to cover that?
Yeah, we do. Go ahead. Okay, oh, yeah. We got 7-8 minutes. Go ahead.
Another argument made use of is that ours is the largest state and must pay in proportion to the other states. How does that appear? The proportion of taxes are fixed by the number of inhabitants and not regulated by the extent of territory or fertility of soil. If we be wealthier in proportion than other states, it will fall lighter upon us than upon poorer states. They must fix the taxes so that the poorest states can pay, and Virginia, being richer, will bear it easier. The honorable gentleman says that the first collections are to go to Congress and that the state legislatures must bear all deficiencies. How does this appear? Does he prove it? Nothing of it appears in the plan itself. The Congress and the state legislatures have concurrent jurisdictions in laying and collecting taxes. There's no rule that shows that Congress shall have the first collections. Each is independent of the other. Another argument against this disingenuous construction is... another argument against this disingenuous construction is drawn from that clause which regulates representation, which is conclusive from the words themselves. Quote, representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, end quote. Each state will know from its population its proportion of any general tax. As it was justly observed by the gentleman over the way, Mr. Randolph, they cannot possibly exceed that proportion. They are limited and restrained expressly to it. The state legislatures have no check of this kind. Their power is uncontrolled. This excludes the danger of interference. Each collects its own taxes and bears its own deficiencies, and officers are accountable to each government for the different collections.
Okay. So that was 2 minutes. I mean, that took you about 2 minutes to read. So there's time, I think, to actually do the next one, the general defense and welfare, and we can kind of, you know, analyze both of these comments. So go ahead.
Okay. General defense and welfare. It provides, quote, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, end quote. The debts of the Union ought to be paid. Ought not the common defense to be provided for? Is it not necessary to provide for the general welfare? It has been fully proved that this power could not be given to another body. The amounts to be raised are confined to these purposes solely. Will oppressive burdens be warranted by this clause? They are not to raise the money for any other purpose. Is it a power which is drawn from his favorite confederation? The 8th article of which provides that all charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare and allowed by the United States in Congress assembled shall be defrayed out of the common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the value of all lands within each state granted to or surveyed from any person as such land, and the building and improvement thereon shall be estimated according to such mode as the United States and Congress assembled shall from time to time direct and appoint. That doesn't sound familiar.
Well, so he's kind of generalizing the Confederation, the Articles of Confederation there. And so he's just comparing that even the Articles of Confederation tried to do that, but they didn't have the power to collect. But before that, he even makes, that's why he says that it is a power which is drawn from his favorite confederation, this Articles of Confederation that he wants to maintain. You know, because obviously whoever he's addressing that spoke before him, and I'm looking, I don't see Henry, so it must have been Mr. Harrison. But nevertheless, he's kind of laying out this real, I think a good succinct argument that, you know, the state government has no checks on being fair and how much tax, and it has general powers of taxation. The federal government has very specific powers because they can only spend, or they can only tax for what they spend their money on. The right. state can actually tax beyond that.
Okay.
Because the state isn't bound by enumerated powers at that point in time. This is why all of the state constitutions were really kind of redone. Every single one of them was redone after the U.S. Constitution. I think Massachusetts did theirs in 1800 or 1801.
Okay.
So anyway, and I, there were several. As a matter of fact, I think New York has a clause in their constitution that they actually convene into a constitutional convention every 20 years, unless by vote of the people, they feel it's not necessary.
See, Missouri has something like that, but it's the opposite. What goes to the polls, the election, every 20 years is, shall we have a constitutional convention? We had this in the last election. Okay, so it is it's a ballot item. Shall we have a constitutional convention, yes or no? And so our state constitution mandates that's a question to be asked every 20 years. And so that's interesting.
Yeah, so a lot of the older states in the union have that. But you know why the newer states in the union didn't include that?
No.
Because the federal government didn't want them to. Because they already got them to actually subjugate themselves to the federal government. If they if they basically encouraged them to say, you need to reexamine your constitution every 20 years, there would have been a good likelihood that they would have actually amended their constitution, taking away those hooks that the federal government convinced them to put in the first place that they had no authority to do.
You're right. Particularly the Western states.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, the later states that joined the Union, yes. After the Civil War. Yeah. Yes. And so we got less than a minute. Any other before we close this this episode?
No. I think it's been, again, very educational. I certainly appreciate you sharing this time or letting me share this time with you. And I'm getting much out of the ratification debates. They truly are a treasure, and I believe Excellent. That it can be disseminated.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to you coming back next week. We'll have you back on Tuesday doing the same thing until we get all the way through the ratification debates. We've got two more states behind Virginia. We've got a lot of Virginia to go through. And so, anyway.
Yeah, it's got 432 pages, but we're a third of the way through.
Yeah. Well, actually, you're going to notice that there's a lot of notes, more notes as they, especially when we get to June 14th. But anyway,
yeah, okay.
I usually don't get a chance to say this, but I really appreciate you coming on. There goes our outgoing music. So we're done for today, folks. I can't emphasize enough the importance of these ratification debates, that this is probably the best service any patriot could give you, especially at no cost to you. And so I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities,
responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.